This week, we bring you a story about the world's most famous hacker, Kevin Mitnick. This is Just Inquiring. Welcome to Life World.
Damn it.
You almost made it.
I almost made it. Damn it. Hi, Derek.
Hi.
It's your turn. What you got?
All right. So for this episode, I decided to dig into the story and history, which is basically several cases of Kevin David Mitnick.
Oh, you got the middle name already going. Like, he's in trouble already.
I honestly don't know how to respond to that. So sure.
You never got yelled at with all three names, and that's how you knew that you were really in trouble?
Fair. I was just doing like more biography style. Again, I'm still getting used to doing a true crime podcast.
I mean, same.
But Kevin was born August 6, 1963 in Van Nuys, California.
Today.
Holy shit. Wow. I did not plan that at all.
That's so cute. So he's 57 today.
Hey, happy birthday, Kevin. We're going to talk about the shitty things you did. So he was said to have grown up in a fairly normal life, but he showed a above normal street smarts as well as book smarts.
Which is not typical. You usually get one or the other, but not both.
Not something I'd consider for Van Nuys, California, for sure.
Right.
Sorry to any Van Nuys listeners. I don't know how you downloaded this podcast.
Okay, I'll see you in hell. It's good. It's cool.
So the reason I say that, at least in my opinion, he showed above average street smarts and book smarts, his first documented case of him using that intelligence for nefarious purposes actually goes all the way back to when he was just 12 years old. He pretty much started to use social engineering in a way that was actually pretty clever by convincing an LA bus driver to give him the information on where to get a ticket punching machine for a, quote, school project, which in itself isn't that crazy, except that he also found where to dumpster dive to get those bus tickets to then punch with said machine so he could ride on the LA bus system for free.
I know people like this, so keep going. It's sounding oddly familiar.
I do too, but at 12 years old, that's the part that's like, huh, okay.
Yeah, fair.
Because at 12 years old, I was riding my bike everywhere because I was too cheap to figure out how to do all that shit.
As was he. He just didn't want to ride his bike either.
Apparently. So as Mitnick got older, he began to become more fascinated by telephone technology and computers, which, as you do, growing up in the early 80s, I guess. Yeah, no, it would have been 70s.
70s, yeah.
As he was becoming more fascinated by telephone technology and computers, which any tech nerd having access to the early days of computer networking and things like that, he started to become fascinated with the possibilities of what he could do with it. So as he was still in his early childhood, he began to use a method called phreaking, which is spelled phreaking.
And it's not... That sounds dirty.
Except you remember it's computer nerd lingo, so it's less dirty at that point.
What they find dirty and what I find dirty may be different.
Fair.
So fill us in.
Now, phreaking has been around for a while, but around this time, it would have been where a person would use a specific device to play a certain tone over the phone, which would cause the now automatic switchboards on the other end to basically end the call without hanging up. So it would leave the line open for people to continue to talk, which if you were to do it from a payphone, that quarter that you put in meant that you could make a long distance call with zero cost to you.
Was it only on payphones?
It was on, I believe it was multiple phones, but generally if you were doing something like this, you would want to use an anonymous means, which a payphone would be.
The reason that I think of it is that another issue for me growing up without a lot in the way of resources was making a long distance call was financially a big deal.
Oh, totally. Especially around this time. Yeah,
exactly. And so we watched the minutes and we would, you know, hang up before a certain, I don't remember whether it's 10 minutes or 15.
Or make a call after like 8 o'clock at night.
Oh my God.
Yeah. See, Now, for those of you who...
Now kids.
Who are now kids, basically, yeah, you had to worry about certain call times because rates were higher for long distance at different times of the day. Even just calling between area codes within your state would even trigger that sometimes. It was a huge pain in the ass.
Right. And that's why, that's what makes me think that it may not have been a public phone, only mm-hmm. because if he's already in the mindset of, I'm going to save bus fare.
Yeah, I guess.
You know, I don't know.
I don't know. I've never done phone phreaking myself, so.
It sounds a lot dirtier than it is. It really does.
Yeah, it does. So with that, he started to learn kind of the ins and outs of the way the telephone networks would work and really became just ingrained in that style of technology. Fast forwarding to 1981, Kevin, now being 17, decided that he needed to advance along with technology as he moved into a bigger role as a black hat hacker. And for those not familiar, basically a black hat hacker is someone who's trying to gain something, whether it be monetarily, if they're trying to gain information, or pretty much anything for a personal gain. On the other hand, however, we have another term which will come up later in this story, the white hat hacker, which is a hacker that's trying to find holes in a security system to basically break it so we can then fix it and make it better.
Right. So, the white hats are paid to do so, and the black hats are paying themselves to do so.
Generally, yeah. So, back to 1981, Kevin, along with a couple of his friends, decided to use his street smarts mixed with his tech smarts by breaking into a Pacific Bell office, specifically Cosmos, the computer system for mainframe operations office. So that way he was able to then get his hands on security keys, manuals for those computer systems, as well as different office names and numbers. So then he could once again use his social engineering to break into more of the systems.
Yeah. So, I mean, mainframe means more a physical in-house network kind of concept. It tends to be idiosyncratic to each company. Would build its own mainframe, and so IBM's mainframe did not speak to Xerox's mainframe, did not speak to Pacific Bell's mainframe.
Yeah, this is still early on, so you're not going to have the World Wide Web as we know it. At this point, I'm not even sure you would have BBS systems at this point.
Yeah, I don't think so. Before AOL, I think it's before BBS's. And so just computers are a thing, but at this point, it's not, well, it's the difference between social engineering and social network.
Yes.
Right. That social engineering has to do with how people used tech early on and that mainframe within a company, how they dealt with their filing or that kind of deal. But this wasn't for fun. You know, any sort of hacker at this point in time was looking for ways to break the system.
Yeah.
Not just in a, I'm going to send out 5,000 emails from some random account just for fun.
Yeah, it was more prank troll culture very early on, especially, and this might be something we cover in another episode, but there were various phone lines that you would be able to call into or hack into to then be kind of a anti-establishment yuppie culture of, the man's doing this, what are we going to do about it? So it does lead to more later on.
Yeah, well, but that too didn't have to be yuppie necessarily because there was I grew up in upstate New York and it was a couple of years after this that it was a thing, but there was a phone line that you could call in to get the specific time and the weather. And if you and your friends sort of aligned your watches, aligned your clocks, you could call in at the same time and sort of shout at each other over the time. And that's one way that you would break the system. I mean, or so I hear.
And meanwhile, Kate is now outing herself as a freaker.
I really am.
But basically, after he decided to break into Pacific Bell, get all this information, and kind of advance his craft, one of the workers at the company caught on to the rerouting of certain phone numbers and eventually notified authorities. This, of course, led to Mitnick being caught and sentenced in a juvenile court to 3 months in prison and a year of probation. So for all intent and purposes, kind of a slap on the wrist. He did go to a juvenile prison. It wasn't, you know, a full adult prison at that point. But enough to say, hey, we don't know what to do with hackers, so here.
They probably would do basically the same thing now, realistically.
This case would beg argue otherwise later on.
I'm saying that for a first offense now.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. For a first offense, for definitely.
That's what they would do still now. Like, we don't generally take first offenses very seriously.
So after serving his time and a couple other stints for various hacking that he got busted for, we move on to 1994, where Kevin is now 31 years old. And he decides that he needs to improve his digital nomadism by finding ways to keep up with the mobile phone industry.
And that's early days.
It's very early days, but it is the way that technology is advancing at this point. He can see the cellular telephone companies moving forward. Landlines could possibly not be a thing, so let's go ahead and get ahead of it.
Yeah, no, he's choosing the correct direction for the technology.
Totally.
And I would be fascinated to know what he did for his 20s. Like, we don't know, sounds like.
There's minor stuff. The really hard part is trying to find actual documented, and maybe with a little bit more digging I could have. There's talks that he had broken into other telecommunications companies, networks, that he might have possibly broken into NORAD at one point, which honestly had a call-in telephone number. So it's really hard to figure out where the legend and the truth are in this, as he did become a fairly big prominent name in the hacking scene. So it's just kind of hard to parse that out.
Sure. And I mean, I would think a lot of his 20s were figuring out how not to get caught.
Yeah. And he eventually did, like, reading into his full bio, which I'm not going to dig into. He did finish high school. He went to college, things like that. So obviously he would have been trying to find a source of income. And I mean, he in his early 20s, you're probably out partying and doing stuff like that as well.
I didn't do that in my early 20s, so somebody's got to.
So, yeah, back to 1994, Kevin decides that he's going to use his social engineering that he's been relying on and very good with up to this point. And he manages to break into the personal home computer system of a man by the name of Tsutomu Shimomura. Now, this guy is an information security researcher slash white hat hacker who was working for various companies trying to build up their security and would give lectures at various colleges about telecommunications. So Kevin, knowing that this guy was a white hat hacker, he was going to have some fun tools to play with that would help him out. So Shimomura, who was now coming back from a Christmas vacation, so again, kind of back into the social engineering, Kevin knew he would probably be out of town. Shimomura, coming back, did find that his network had been accessed from an outside source, and that the software that he was using for his research was, of course, downloaded. Shortly thereafter, he did find his software after doing some digging online. He found his software being used on a service called The Well, which was based out of San Francisco. Which I couldn't really see a whole lot of, or find a whole lot of information about The Well. I'm not sure if it was just like a depository for various files, like, you know, a GitHub or something like that, or if it was just like a telecommunication system.
It doesn't ring a bell for me.
Okay. But basically, finding his software that he would use, his personal stuff, on The Well, Shimomura decided that he would use his skills as a hacker to then track the calls that were being made through this service. So I guess it was kind of a telecommunications base.
Yeah, it sounds like, you know, in some, it depends on...
Or that someone was accessing those files through that, possibly.
Right. That's what it would seem like. Like, so... Yeah, bulletin board systems or whatever, you know, there were file share options. It was, okay. My first experience with downloading something I was not supposed to be downloading back in the day, this was about the same time, I guess, around 94 or so. And I downloaded the entire script of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. I'm badass.
I mean, if you're going to break the law...
And I mean, arguably, I mean, I think it was a little bit earlier than that, because I think it was more like 14, 15. So that would have been earlier 90s. But arguably I might not have realized quite how illegal it was at the time. And it wasn't, I mean, it wasn't that big a deal. It's not like I went and used it as a production of anything.
Yeah, yeah.
It was mostly just to see what I could get away with. And until right now, I got away with it. So I'm pretty sure that I don't have it anymore. But like, so I had, it was, I mean, literally probably a 2-inch thick pile of the dot matrix. All one long feed.
Oh, yeah.
It was this, the script of Rocky.
Where you had to pull the ribbon off the side of it and the whole
nine.
That's
the one. Yeah. And then you have to fold it into like worm shapes and play with it. Yeah. Yeah, 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 yeah. So that, and so from what I understand, and this is way back now, Jesus Christ. But I believe that I went to a regular BBS to look around and find it, and then went to a file service where you effectively like call in and download the file, and it was more than one floppy disk kind of thing.
Gotcha.
So it sounds like that may be what we're talking about. And so I'm sure that if I got caught with it somewhere coded in the file on the floppy, said where it came from. And so if somebody was able to trace it to me in that way, they'd be able to tell who gave it to me in the first place.
Okay, gotcha.
People are learning all kinds of new things about me, aren't they?
Now it all makes sense why Kate keeps wanting to talk about hackers and technology.
I'm curious. It's just curiosity.
Which is the excuse that Mitnick was using throughout most of this. So I'm just saying. But anyway, Shimomura ended up working with a cellular phone service company to trace the calls that were being made to the well and decided that he would involve the FBI at this point. All of this information did help them lead back to Mitnick, who was now residing in North Carolina, where he was arrested in February of 1995. So their little game of cat and mouse only lasted for about a month and a half, maybe 2 months. Which, I mean, more power to Shimomura on that one. He totally caught it.
Well, and I think also, that's why I was asking about what did Mitnick do in his 20s, because it sounds like he kind of got complacent.
And that's the interesting thing about it, because reading into it, and I'm not sure if I added this to my notes, I don't think I did, but he kind of prided himself, again, not sure if this is just legend or truth at this point, but he would hack in various systems, and while the FBI supposedly would try to track him down, he had ways to track their movements through those call systems. So much so that his apartment would be empty by the time they showed up, and supposedly there would just be a box of donuts sitting there waiting for them. Which is one of those stories where it can't be that true.
It sounds apocryphal to me. Like,
yeah.
He might have some ways, but one person acting alone isn't that much smarter than the FBI. But a lot of hackers and I mean, just BBS assholes at the time would go well out of their way to try and build up their own mystique.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, as far as a mystique applies to a 1990s hacker, like they were not mystique filled young gentlemen. They were jailbait or they were nerds. Like that's what it was. I'd like you to guess which one I was. No, don't guess, actually.
Well, we already figured out you were the hacker, so.
I was freaky, yeah, sure. Jesus Christ.
See, the funny part is this, like, what I scripted, I was like, I wonder if it's going to be long enough for this. Yep, totally fine. So once Kevin's apartment was raided, he was actually found with over 100 cloned cell phone codes, false IDs, and cloned phone hardware. So not stuff you want to get caught with. This eventually led with him being charged with 14 counts of wire fraud, 8 counts of possession of unauthorized access devices, interception of wire and electronic communications, unauthorized access to a federal computer, and causing damage to a computer. Which I like that they just tack that little bit on at the end, just in case.
Causing damage to a computer. Hardcore, man.
Right? It's like, oh no, I dropped it. Shit, I'm going to jail.
I'm going to jail. Exactly. Gravity equals jail.
So 4 years later, Mitnick did reach a plea agreement, and he was ultimately convicted of 4 counts of the wire fraud, 1 count of illegally intercepting a wire communication, as the Shimomura one was the reason he was there, 2 counts of computer fraud, and violation of his previous release sentence from 1989, in which he was supposed to quit doing these just asshole things and to not associate with hackers.
Which is hilarious. Like, I love, it happens all the time with terms of probation and parole, where they'll tack stuff on that I'm sure sounds really good in the judge's chambers. And mm-hmm. the rest of us look at that like, how on earth are you going to know? How are you going to track, you know, don't associate with hackers. So if you sit next to one in Starbucks, are you going to jail? Like, where do you draw that line and how do you know? And who are his friends? Who are his family? You know, they're going to be hackers.
They're going to be the technology hacker people that he was meeting in college.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Common interests. This ultimately resulted in a 5-year prison sentence, with 4.5 years being served pretrial and 8 months in solitary confinement, which caused a lot of controversy and outrage because, and we'll get into it in a moment, the reason behind it, but basically the hacking community saw this as just completely unfair and ridiculous. So they started going out with different magazines, giving out bumper stickers of Free Kevin. There was supposedly threats posted on a defamed Yahoo page, like their main Yahoo page was defaced, as well as other major companies. But the reason he was given the solitary confinement sentence was, according to Kevin, because of the law enforcement telling the judge that he would be able to, quote, start a nuclear war by whistling into a payphone.
Jesus Christ.
So someone watched way too much War Games, is my guess.
Oh, God. The only way to win is not to play at all.
So after his release in 2001, Kevin did move on to become a white hat hacker, and he actually started his own security consulting firm. To date, his firm does continue to support various corporations with cybersecurity concerns, and he continues to give lectures at conferences about cybersecurity as well as communications.
A happy ending.
Yeah, ultimately a happy ending. So he has been the subject of various books, like the one that he co-wrote, I believe, Ghost in the Wires. He was also the subject of a movie called Takedown or Trackdown, depending where in the world you are. It's named one or the other, which was more of the dramatization with Shimamura's side of things, tracking down the evil hacker, which Mitnick eventually did put out a documentary himself, or was part of a documentary that kind of debunked a lot of what was in that story. So again, truth and legend being separated, but all of this media attention with him being kind of the first big profile hacker to be captured and sentenced, as well as the various books and movies, did ultimately put him out there as the world's most famous hacker.
Yeah, I mean, and that's one of the things that I was thinking about, is that the idea of legend and who, where the truth lies. He had a lot of stake himself in playing it up, you know, in building his own persona.
He did. But the interesting part about it is that, I mean, he wasn't really famous until he was caught.
That's what I'm saying, though. That's kind of what I mean is in retrospect, playing up his own persona, how badass he was, and knowing prison culture as an employee, not as an inmate.
Kate was not thrown in solitary for hacking into NORAD.
I really wasn't. I just stayed in Gen Pop. No, that a hacker, he's going to be, let's go with stereotype, that he's going to be a smaller guy, that he's going to be kind of the egghead. You don't want to be on the yard.
True. And he had a history of social engineering. So obviously he's going to figure out, okay, how can I talk my way out of this?
And that may mean sitting in solitary. Like, there are a lot of people who cannot cope with solitary. It breaks something in them. But if he knows he's only got to serve 8 months.
Yeah.
And he's allowed to do some, I mean, a lot of his life is in his own head, working his own way mentally through things. Because, you know, a lot of hackers, you can't really do the thing until you're in the system. Like, you can only plan so far. So there's not that much you need to read or to write. It's a lot of sort of mentally guessing what you're going to encounter. So solitary is kind of, if he's got to do time, that's the way to do it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, the downside to being found guilty is that it restricts ultimate travel and it's going to cost a lot of money and that sort of thing. But otherwise, you know, marketing himself as the white hat hacker, which is really doesn't flow off the tongue the way a lot of...
Right?
You know, hat hacker, just, I don't like it.
Well, and that's why typically it's just white hat or black hat. It's a lot easier to say.
It is, but you get black cat or black hat and whatever.
You know what? If you can train your black cat to hack into NORAD and whistle to launch nukes, then we have a bigger problem here. And I am covering the wrong story. This week, we bring you a story about the world. See? See, it makes it so much worse that there's a camera because I can see you trying to hide it.
You make eye contact when you do it.
Just stare directly into the camera as I talk like this. See, I think it kind of works that it's that funny right off the bat because then it just loosens it up for us to be cynical and make jokes. So it's a benefit.
Well, good, because I can't yet. I'm trying. I'm not there yet. I could stare at you the whole time. I could do it. I have to take my glasses off.
That's just cheating.
No. I can still see. I don't want my glasses to get all steamed up at the voice, Derek.
Oh, gotcha. Yep, I kicked Justin out of the seat, so now we can actually do our episode.
Oh, see, I assumed you were just going to sit on his lap.
He's a little too brooding for that. He's always leaning against a wall. It makes it really hard to sit on his lap.
That's the best time.
Maybe for some. I prefer comfort.
Okay, man.